Content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading from the October 16th, 2015 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Battle lines forming over Pacific trade deal. What happened? Negotiators from the U.S., Japan, and 10 other Pacific Rim nations agreed to the largest regional trade accord in history this week, setting up a long and potentially divisive battle for approval in Congress. While the full text of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP, has not yet been released, the White House said the deal would eliminate 18,000 tariffs on American exports, tighten labor and environmental standards abroad, provide greater protection for intellectual property rights, and overhaul the dispute settlement system for multinational companies. The 12 nations involved, Australia, Brunei, Canada, Chile, Japan, Malaysia, Mexico, New Zealand, Peru, Singapore, and the U.S. and Vietnam, account for almost 40% of global GDP and a third of world trade. All 12 must now convince their lawmakers to approve the deal. "We can't let countries like China write the rules of the global economy," said President Obama, adding that the TPP would give American companies and workers the fair shot at success they deserve. Opposition to the deal comes from both sides of the political divide. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, a Democratic presidential candidate, called the TPP a victory for Wall Street and other big corporations. His rival Hillary Clinton, who called the TPP the gold standard of trade deals when she was Secretary of State, also came out against the deal, saying it had failed to meet a high bar of helping American workers. Orrin Hatch, the Republican chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, said the accord appears to fall woefully short of what's required for congressional approval. 90 days after it receives the full text of the treaty, Congress can hold an up or down vote on whether to approve it. What the editorial said: "It's nonsensical for people like Sanders and Hatch to pass instant judgment on a complex book-length trade agreement they haven't even read yet," said the Baltimore Sun. "Like all trade deals, the TPP will have winners and losers. Some U.S. workers will lose their jobs as companies shift their activities abroad. Others will benefit as their employers prosper from having greater access to foreign markets. But spare us the suggestion that every concession is a triumph of big business over average Americans. Average Americans benefit, too, when new jobs are created and cheaper imports become available." "The deal looks promising," said BloombergView.com. "It should open up trade in agriculture and services, establish much-needed regulation for the digital economy, and pare back restrictions on international investment. Ultimately, more trade means more competition, which means higher productivity, hence better products and lower prices. Like technological progress, free trade is disruptive but necessary." What the columnist said: "This is a bad deal for most Americans," said Lori Wallach in NYTimes.com. "Negotiated in secret with the help of hundreds of corporate interest advisors, the TPP would encourage U.S. firms to move abroad by eliminating risks otherwise associated with producing in low-wage countries. And it puts American workers in direct competition with Vietnamese workers who are paid less than 65 cents an hour." Make no mistake, this deal is all about China, said John Fitchie in WSJ.com. excluding the Asian powerhouse from TPP, for now at least, ensures that the U.S. will remain a dominant economic force in the Pacific Rim. If Congress rejects this deal, not only will Americans look like fools to the rest of the world, but only China will fill the vacuum with a regional trade partnership of its own. Is that really a better alternative? What both sides are missing is what a trivial issue they are fighting over, said Jeffrey Dorfman in Forbes.com. The U.S. already has free or very close to free trade with most of the largest nations in the TPP, Canada, Mexico, and Australia. And even pro-trade groups admit the TPP would boost the U.S. economy by 0.4% of GDP at most. Yes, there will be winners and losers, but on a scale that pales in comparison with the ordinary fluctuations in the job market. But in the hyperpartisan climate gripping Washington, lawmakers will turn the TPP into another theatrical struggle. So prepare for a really big fight over really tiny impacts. Our controversy of the week, Oregon massacre. Would new gun laws stop mass shootings? 9 people were shot dead last week at a community college in Oregon, said Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post. And at first, it didn't seem worth writing about. Almost. The details were numbingly familiar. A troubled male loner with an arsenal of high-powered guns demonstrating his rage to a world that had ignored his psychic pain. And in a nation that's lived through countless such horrors without tightening its gun laws one iota, what is left to say? As an angry President Obama reminded us last week, we are the only advanced country on earth that sees these kinds of mass shootings every few months. Our political choice to do nothing in response, Obama said, puts the blood from this week's massacre and next week's on all of our hands. This was one of the most powerful statements Obama has delivered since taking office, said John Cassidy in NewYorker.com. But thanks to the gun lobby's implacable grip on Congress, particularly the Republican side, there is virtually no prospect of tighter gun laws anytime soon. Obama's remarks were morally and intellectually offensive, said Pete Wenner in CommentaryMagazine.com. There is no evidence that the common sense gun control measures the president demonizes Republicans for blocking, universal background checks and bans on large capacity magazines and assault rifles, would have prevented the Oregon attack or reduced gun violence in general. Obama tripped his hand, said Mark Wright in NationalReview.com, when he approvingly cited the gun laws in Australia without any details. After a mass shooting in 1996, Australia required citizens to demonstrate a genuine need to buy a gun, and 650,000 assault weapons were taken out of circulation, about a fifth of all guns in the country. Liberals may love the idea of federal agents seizing weapons from millions of lawful owners, but in America, let me be clear, that is not going to happen. Why don't we focus on the real problem, said National Review in an editorial. The common thread in these tragedies is not the killer's choice of weapons, but his unhinged state of mind. Liberals pushed the deinstitutionalization movement of the 1960s that made it almost impossible to keep mentally ill people safely locked up. Most mass killings are the direct result of our national unwillingness to act credibly on mental illness. And our culture is ill as well, said John Cass in the Chicago Tribune. How can we entertain ourselves with blood-soaked action movies, rage-filled music that glorifies murder, and the ritualized gladiatorial violence of pro football? then act surprised when a madman shoots up a classroom. Those are just excuses for inaction, said Amanda Marcotte in RollingStone.com. Of course, we should reform our woefully inadequate mental health system. But why not also limit killers' access to the tools that let them rack up those mind-blowing death counts in the space of mere seconds? No single new law is going to solve the problem of gun violence, said Nicholas Kristof in the New York Times. But we dramatically cut the rate of auto fatalities through the passage of multiple regulations, requiring driver's license, seat belts, airbags, safety glass, etc. If we take the same incremental approach to guns, universal background checks, safe storage laws, and careful licensing of gun owners, we might save thousands of lives every year. Locking up all angry loners in advance is not an option. We're all crazy if we can't take modest steps to reduce the carnage that leaves America resembling a battlefield. It was a good week for nature's resilience after scientists reported that the radioactive exclusion zone around the Chernobyl nuclear power plant is now teeming with wildlife, including elk, deer, wild boar, and wolves, and now rivals the world's most abundant nature preserves. It was a good week for leading by example after Representative David Jolly, a Republican from Florida, introduced a bill requiring members of the Do Nothing Congress to work at least 40 hours a week. A work week in Washington, he said, should be no different than a work week in every other town. And it was a good week for pork fat after the world's oldest woman, Susanna Muschat Jones, 116, credited her longevity to starting every day with a meal of bacon and eggs. A sign in Jones' kitchen in Brooklyn reads, "Bacon makes everything better." But it was a bad week for having it their way. After Burger King's Halloween-themed Black Whopper inspired the hashtag green poop thanks to after effects caused by excessive food coloring. It was a bad week for no-shows after a Minnesota couple who were unable to attend a relative's wedding because their babysitter didn't show up received a bill for their missed meal. I was pretty shocked to see that I was being charged $75 for herb-crusted walleye and a service charge, said Jessica Baker. It was a bad week for fashion tips. After TV evangelist Jim Baker warned that God recently told him to wear all black clothes, portending that the end times are near. "I pray about what I wear," Baker said, "and I am in mourning because the people aren't ready." We're on the briefing page now. China's Green Revolution. The world's worst polluter is worried about climate change and is now the biggest global investor in green technologies. How much does China pollute? China has overtaken the U.S. as the world's largest economy, and over the past two decades, its blitz of industrialization has pulled millions of people out of poverty and pumped millions of tons of carbon into the atmosphere. From 2008 to 2013 alone, annual energy consumption in China rose more than 50%. Some 70% of that electricity was generated from the worst possible source, coal. China burns as much coal as the rest of the world combined, and it now emits twice as much total carbon as the U.S., although Americans still lead the world in per capita emissions. You can see the results in the thick black haze the thick haze that blankets Beijing and just about every other city. In fact, just a handful of China's 500 largest cities meet World Health Organization's standards for air quality. How bad is the smog? Air pollution kills more than 500,000 Chinese people every year. Runners in the Beijing International Marathon last year had to wear face masks against the smothering yellow haze. Smog alerts routinely force cities to ban driving and temporarily shut down factories. The filth has begun to cause what Chinese authorities fear most, political unrest. China now has more than 50,000 environmental protests a year, mostly local demonstrations against planned factories and waste incineration plants. Communist Party officials and business leaders aren't happy about the pollution, either. Watching people wearing anti-toxin masks in the capital is pretty embarrassing, said Yun Gongming, head of China Huadian, one of the largest state-owned energy companies. Nobody wants to live in a polluting city for fear of getting diseases. What is China doing about it? China's authorities are making a major push to curb emissions, both to ease smog and alleviate the consequences of climate change. In Washington last month, Chinese President Xi Jinping announced that a national cap-and-trade program, the world's biggest, would begin in 2017. Chinese companies that emit more greenhouse gases than the allowed cap will be fined, while those that emit less can sell their credits. China is also pouring money into renewable energy, investing $90 billion last year alone, more than any other country. It has ramped up its solar power at a staggering rate, building sprawling solar farms on the Gobi Desert and increasing capacity this year by 18 gigawatts, an amount equal to the entire solar capacity of the U.S. China is already the world's largest producer of wind power, with thousands of turbines installed in the windy West and plans to more than double the number of turbines over the next 5 years. It's also the world's largest hydropower producer, home to half the world's 80,000 dams and building many more every year. Is that making a difference? At a 2014 summit with President Obama, Xi pledged that China's emissions would peak by 2030 and then drop. Less than a year later, China is already ahead of that goal, with emissions now predicted to peak in 2025. In the first few months of 2015, China's coal use fell almost 8% compared with last year's, a reduction equal to all the carbon dioxide emitted by the UK over that period. Part of that drop came because of China's economic slowdown. But the country's new commitment to renewables means that even when the economy picks up, the extra power will come from greener sources. In 2009, China pledged to reduce its carbon intensity, the ratio of emissions to energy produced, by 45% by 2020. It's now more than halfway there. So authorities have set themselves a new goal of 65%. Can these numbers be trusted? China has moved so fast to expand the use of green energy that much of its new capacity is just that, capacity. Getting the energy produced hooked up to the power grid so it can be consumed will be a huge challenge. Many of the wind and solar farms, for example, are far from big cities, and authorities haven't yet worked out a way to store and transport all the energy they produce. China's big hydropower projects, such as the Three Gorges Dam, have also displaced millions of people and taken their own toll on the environment. Meanwhile, even though China is ramping up renewables, it is still the world's biggest user of coal, and as Chinese consumers grow more affluent, they use more energy. Last year, China's per capita CO2 emissions passed those of the EU. How will climate talks be affected? A thorny source of discord in global climate talks has been the disconnect between what is expected of rich Western countries and what is expected of developing countries. The 1997 Kyoto Protocol, for example, had no binding limits for emissions by China, India, or any country in Africa or South America, while the U.S. was supposed to slash emissions by 7%. Congressional Republicans were furious at the perceived double standard and blocked U.S. ratification of Kyoto. But China's new push to lower its emissions undercuts the argument that Western efforts to combat climate change won't ultimately make a difference. At the UN climate change conference in Paris at the end of this year, China has said it too will commit to binding emissions cuts. "We should firmly pursue green, low-carbon, circular, and sustainable development," Xi told the UN Assembly last month. China will shoulder its share of the responsibilities. Climate migrants. Climate change has already forced the resettlement of a 250,000 people in China. Over the past 50 years, the average temperature in the central region of Zhihuaigu has risen by nearly 4 degrees Fahrenheit, and rainfall has fallen by a third, making some areas uninhabitable. Until recently, residents relied on stored rainwater, and in dry years spent half their earnings trucking in water just to stay alive. Local authorities finally gave up and relocated the entire town of Zhuatao to the nearby city of Hongzibu, and water was diverted from the Yellow River to accommodate them, all at a cost of some $1 billion. Three main factors led to the ecological fragility of Zhihuaigu: nature, human impact, and climate change. Hohoi University analyst Chen Xiaojun told The Guardian, "As temperatures rise, many more Chinese may be forced to move." Looking at the columns now, we'll take two from the U.S. The first, "Is recycling largely an illusion?" "Recycling may make people feel the warm glow of virtue," said John Tierney, "but it's largely a waste of time and money. After two decades of strenuous efforts to get Americans to recycle, prices for recyclable materials have plummeted, and it's generally more expensive for communities to recycle household waste than to send it to a landfill." "Ah, but we're saving the environment," you say. Not really. Studies show that recycling cardboard, paper, and aluminum cans does make environmental sense. But sorting and recycling glass, food scraps, and all kinds of plastics achieves little or no net environmental gain. When all the impacts are added up, shipping garbage to modern incinerators equipped with effective air scrubbers or to well-insulated landfills causes no more environmental damage than collecting, sorting, shipping, and processing recyclables. Many rural communities welcome landfills as a source of revenue, and all the trash generated by Americans for the next 1,000 years would fit in 0.1% of available land. These facts are heresy to green activists who've turned recycling into a religious ritual and are pushing for 100% of waste to be recycled. But it's a ritual of increasingly dubious value. A politically ignorant majority. Donald Trump's stunning lead in the GOP presidential race reveals a much deeper problem at the heart of modern democracy: widespread voter ignorance, said Ilya Somin. Polls show that 40% of Republicans without college degrees support Trump, as opposed to 19% of college graduates. And the main reason for their support is that he's a self-assured, highly entertaining celebrity who knows how to talk on TV. Since many of his Republican supporters don't know much about politics, it doesn't matter to them that Trump has a long history of liberal stances and support for Democrats. The popularity of his anti-immigration stance, too, is based on ignorance. Immigrants have a lower crime rate than native-born people and provide little or no job competition to natives, since they take mostly menial jobs. The sobering reality is that most Americans, and not just Trump supporters, follow politics and government superficially and don't even know the names of their representatives or which party controls Congress. These low-information voters are ripe for exploitation by manipulative candidates and interest groups. That's the truly frightening reality revealed by the Donald. And this from Russia. Why Putin is right to help Syria. An old Russian proverb says the loudest cries of stop thief tend to come from the thief himself, said Yevgeny Shevgov. That adage comes to mind when we hear American complaints about Russia's military deployment in Syria. Unlike the U.S.-led coalition airstrikes, the Russian military operations in Syria are actually legal. The U.S. received no U.N. mandate to conduct attacks on any groups in Syria. Instead, it justifies its action by saying that since it is helping Baghdad fight the Islamic State of Iraq, it must also pursue ISIS in Syria. Russia, by contrast, was expressly invited by the legitimate government of Syria to battle the terrorists there. While the U.S. offers ever-shifting rationales for its aggressions, which mask its true aim of regime change, Russia has set specific, clear military goals to help President Bashar al-Assad defeat ISIS. Russia has a direct stake in the battle against ISIS, said Sergei Markadanov in RussiaDirect.org. The terrorist group has already earmarked the North Caucasus and Russia as a whole as a target. Its inner circle of leaders contains several Chechens and Georgians, and Russian speakers make up the single largest non-Arab group fighting in Syria. These fighters are even more dangerous to Russia than European jihadis are to Europe. While the Europeans fear that their nationals might return to commit terrorist acts, Russians know that their nationals could come home and start actual insurgencies against Russian interests and rule in Chechnya or Dagestan, as one European intelligence officer put it. Russians also have a significant economic interest in keeping Assad in power to protect our gas exports. Qatar has been seeking easy access to the European markets for natural gas by floating the idea of building a pipeline across Syria to Turkey. Assad has refused to assent to such a deal, largely because of religious differences between the Qatari Sunnis and his own Alawite Shiite sect. Were he to fail, Qatar could, using its considerable wealth, persuade whoever takes his place to build the pipeline. Russia, currently the main supplier of natural gas to Europe, would have to cut its prices to remain competitive. Yet the main reason for President Vladimir Putin to intervene in Syria is simply to show that he can, said Sergei Strokhan. Analyst Dmitry Polikanov said his Russia's presence in Syria shows a return to the stage as a global power, an active and successful fighter against evil in the world. After more than a year of being shunned and isolated over the annexation of Crimea, Russia is now invited to the table again. The struggle in Syria, then, is less about ISIS and more about who will play first fiddle in world politics. And now moving on to the last word, heroin's new frontier. Mexican cartels are fueling a heroin surge in the U.S., said Todd Frankel, targeting small cities like Dayton, Ohio. He practiced with baby carrots, swallowing them whole, easing them down his throat with yogurt. Later came the heroin pellets, each loaded with 14 grams of powder, machine wrapped in wax paper and thick latex. Long gone were the days of swallowing hand-knotted drug-filled condoms. The Mexican drug trafficking organizations were always perfecting their craft. On this trip, Gerardo Vargas would swallow 71 pellets, a full kilo, just over 2 pounds, enough for as many as 30,000 hits at $10 a pop on American streets. And so before he set off on his 3,900-mile journey from Uruapan, Mexico, Vargas had been given the rules. No soda, because it could erode the pellet's wrapping. No orange juice either. Drink only water. He was told which airports to avoid, his every move orchestrated by his handler in Mexico. And don't eat anything, he was told, until reaching the final destination, Dayton, Ohio, one of the new frontiers of the American heroin epidemic. A sophisticated farm-to-arm supply chain is fueling America's surging heroin appetite, causing heroin to surpass cocaine and meth to become the nation's number one drug threat for the first time. As demand has grown, the flow of heroin, a once taboo drug now easier to score in some cities than crack or pot, has changed too. Mexican cartels have overtaken the U.S. heroin trade, imposing an almost corporate discipline. They grow and process the drug themselves, increasingly replacing their traditional black tar with an innovative, high-quality power with mass-market appeals. It can be smoked or snorted by newcomers, as well as shot up by hardcore addicts. They have broadened distribution beyond the old big-city heroin centers like Chicago and New York to target unlikely places such as Dayton. The mid-size Midwestern city today is considered to be an epicenter of the heroin problem, with addicts buying and overdosing in unsettling droves. Crack dealers on street corners have been supplanted by heroin dealers ranging across a far wider landscape, almost invisible to law enforcement. They arrange deals by cell phone and deliver heroin like pizza. In August 2014, a window opened into this shadowy world. A tip led federal drug agents to Vargas, a low-level courier willing to tell them what he knew in exchange for leniency. Sometimes, one agent later explained, the dope gods smile. Vargas was the perfect drug mule. He was 22 but looked younger. He'd been born in California, moving to Mexico at age 12 after his father was deported, so he possessed a U.S. passport. He also had a spotless record, perfect English, and a desperate need for cash. His father had already lost one eye to diabetes. He'd been offered $6 a gram. This job would earn him nearly $6,000. Things could go wrong. Another courier headed to Dayton had to use the bathroom unexpectedly during a layover at a U.S. airport and lost his pellets when the toilet flushed automatically, according to the drug agents who finally arrested him. Pellets bursting is a courier's worst fear. Once in Lorain, Ohio, a courier started foaming at the mouth, and his handler called down to Mexico to figure out what to do. As authorities listened via wiretap, the handler was told to cut the courier open and retrieve the remaining drugs. This wasn't supposed to happen with heroin. The drug has a reputation as a rough ride, and for years, treatment centers saw few heroin addicts. But that started changing in the mid-2000s and took off a few years later after a government crackdown on opioid painkiller abuse. Unable to get pills, many addicts turned to heroin, the painkiller's chemical cousin. Today, authorities estimate there are between 435,000 and 1.5 million heroin users in the United States. Treatment centers are once again flooded with young users, many of whom got their start on prescription drugs. In Montgomery County, home to Dayton, heroin-related deaths have skyrocketed 225% since 2011. Last year, this county of 540,000 residents reported 127 fatal heroin overdoses, one of the highest rates in the nation. The coroner can't keep up, said Robert Carlson, a Wright State University ethnographer who helps track overdoses. There's not enough room to keep all the bodies. Just as U.S. authorities were cracking down on painkillers, Mexican cartels were figuring out how to make high-quality powder heroin. For decades, Mexicans dealt primarily in homegrown black tar heroin, a crude concoction that looks like its name. It is sticky like tree sap and odorous like vinegar. Its appeal is limited, and it was sold almost exclusively west of the Mississippi River. East of the Mississippi, the Colombians pushed powder heroin. But moving beyond black tar made sense for the Mexicans. Powder was a better product, stronger. It was easier to smuggle, too. Kilo for kilo, powder took up less room. It was also extremely profitable. A kilo of heroin might cost $5,000 to produce in Mexico, but it could sell for $80,000 to suppliers in the U.S., twice what cocaine fetches. And a street dealer could make $300,000 by diluting the kilo and doling it out to addicts a tenth of a gram at a time. For the drug cartel La Familia Michoacana, shipping powder straight to smaller markets such as Dayton meant no more sharing with suppliers in Chicago or New York. I'd never have thought it, but we turned into a sore city, Montgomery County Sheriff Phil Plummer said. To spur demand, dealers started throwing in free tester hits of powder heroin when customers bought pot or crack. Many dealers soon moved to heroin full-time, police and former addicts said. With a belly full of heroin, Vargas followed the same worn path followed by hundreds of other drug mules. He began by hopping a 2:05 p.m. flight from Uruapan to Tijuana, putting him 20 minutes from the U.S.-Mexico border. No one knows how many tons of drugs slip across that border. Authorities only know what they manage to stop. Researchers believe that the detection rate hovers around 1.5%. Favorable odds for a smuggler. The next morning, Vargas and his kilo walked into the San Ysidro border station, the nation's busiest entry point. Waved on, he caught a hired van outside the border station and headed 100 miles north to John Wayne Airport in Santa Ana, California, bypassing the much closer airport in San Diego, which he'd been warned to avoid. Other drug couriers had been arrested there. He caught AirTran Flight 436 to Las Vegas, then jumped on Southwest Flight 2419, but he wasn't flying to Dayton. He'd been warned to avoid that airport, too. He landed in Indianapolis at 1:19 a.m., In the pre-dawn hours, Vargas hailed a cab for the two-hour ride to Dayton. After 3,900 miles and 37 hours, Vargas checked into a $45 a night room at the Dayton Motor Motel. He was in room 8. On the streets, heroin is called girl. Crack is boy. And the switch from boy to girl has complicated the job for drug cops like Sergeant John Sullivan, who heads Dayton's undercover drug unit. In the transition from crack to heroin, said Sullivan, the business model has totally changed. The crack trade at least had a physical location. There were crack houses, drug corners, runners. Police knew which neighborhoods to focus on. With heroin, it's mobile phones and car-to-car transactions. The deals can take place in mall parking lots, at gas stations in suburbs. Dealers will come to you, what's known as the pizza delivery model. There's no geography to it anymore, said Lee Hoffer, an ethnographer at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland who is studying heroin users. And the dealers have gotten smarter. Tired of losing personal vehicles to drug forfeiture laws, they use rentals, which can't be seized, Sullivan said. The end of drug houses means there is nothing for police to raid or rival dealers to rob. Turf wars have disappeared along with the turf. Drug dealers realized they could live anywhere. Some moved out to the suburbs. One moved into the same upscale apartment building as Sullivan. The business now is all about the phone. A drug dealer's phone, filled with customers' numbers, is so valuable that it's known as a money phone. The information is often backed up onto other phones or stored on computers in Mexico. When police seize a money phone, they have to seal it in a special bag to block cell signals so dealers can't erase its memory remotely. Logistically, said Captain Mike Brim of the Montgomery County Sheriff's Office, heroin is a nightmare. The afternoon after he arrived, Vargas emerged from his hotel room. He walked across the parking lot, never seeming to notice the undercover drug cops parked around the perimeter. The next afternoon, Jason Bia, a DEA special agent, and another agent knocked on Vargas' door. Vargas did not seem surprised. He let them in. Bia noticed a trash can that had been used as a toilet, a sign of a body courier. Vargas permitted the agents to search the rooms. They found a plastic bag filled with heroin pellets hidden in the toilet tank. Vargas began to talk. He told his life story, how he was married father of two, how his father was sick with diabetes. Then Vargas mentioned that he had one last pellet inside him. Villa rushed Vargas to the hospital. He didn't want the pellet to burst. Vargas faced serious prison time, 10 years to life. His best shot at helping himself was to talk. So he spilled the details of his trips. It was clear how little Vargas knew. He was a babe in the woods, his attorney, Patrick Mulligan, said. At his sentencing in January, Vargas was remorseful. The judge gave him 2 years. Recently, county detectives were closing in on another courier holed up in another local motel. This time, the courier was a woman, as many are these days, a fresh sign of the ever-changing tactics. But the dope gods were not smiling this time. They just missed her. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in the Washington Post. Moving on to the health and science page, I have a few short articles here. The first, crab invasion threatens Antarctica. For tens of millions of years, the frigid waters off Antarctica's continental shelf have been home to a rich and varied population of soft-bodied organisms such as starfish, sponges, and mollusks. This teeming region is a throwback to the Paleozoic era, before the evolution of predatory crabs and fish. The different species coexist peacefully, feeding on plankton and other matter suspended in the water, which they strain through specialized filtering structures. But as a consequence of global climate change, new research finds this ecosystem faces a new and potentially devastating threat. an invasion of shell-crushing king crabs. These imposing crustaceans live on the Antarctic continental slope, but they haven't penetrated the shallower waters of the adjacent shelf because waters that close to the icy landmass have been too cold. But over the past 50 years, water temperatures off the western Antarctic Peninsula have warmed by about 2.5 degrees Fahrenheit, roughly twice the average rate worldwide, reaching the survivable level for king crabs, which is about 34 degrees. If the crabs do invade and decimate the Antarctic ecosystem, it will show how climate change will impoverish our world, lead author Rich Aronson tells the Christian Science Monitor. Losing all those creatures, he said, would be as tragic as if somebody took Michelangelo's statue of David and threw it in the dumpster. Lasting effects of childhood stress. It's well established that chronic stress can have serious consequences for adults, increasing the risk of heart disease, diabetes, and other disorders. Now, a Harvard University study has found the first evidence that persistent emotional anxiety and turmoil during childhood can have damaging health effects long after kids grow up, even if the stressful experiences have faded into memory. The researchers analyzed a British longitudinal study of 6,714 British children born in a single week in 1958. Over a period of four decades, the subjects' emotional and mental states were assessed several times. By age 45, their risk for diabetes and heart disease was also evaluated. Those who'd faced childhood stress that persisted into adulthood were the most vulnerable to heart disease and diabetes, the researchers found. But even the people with low levels of adult stress were at higher risk for those chronic health issues if they had endured psychological distress as kids. Childhood distress is a serious public health issue in its own right, lead author Ashley Winning tells CBS News. Our research shows it may also set up a trajectory of risk of poor health as people age. Wired for success. Happy and accomplished people generally have an uncanny and at times irritating knack for making connections, and not just the social and professional variety. New research reveals that common measures of success, such as life satisfaction and higher levels of income, are associated with greater connectivity in certain regions of the brain. The more successful people are, the more communication they enjoy between areas of the brain involved in reasoning, memory, imagination, and sociability, Oxford University researchers found. The team analyzed the MRIs of 461 people ages 22 to 35, conducting a computer analysis to identify correlations between various traits and brain circuitry patterns. The study revealed that those with more positive qualities, such as higher memory test scores, better vocabulary, and more education, shared similar patterns of strong connectivity. Meanwhile, those with fewer social and intellectual abilities and who suffered from problems like poor sleep, substance abuse, and anger issues displayed less connectivity in those regions. We've tried to see how we can relate what we see in the brains to behavioral skills we can measure in different people, study leader Stephen Smith tells ScienceAlert.com. In doing this, we hope to be able to understand what goes on under the bonnet of the brain. On the Talking Points page, smartphones changing us for the worse. Let's face it, 2009 was the year that conversation died, said Sherry Turkle in the New York Times. That year, smartphones went mainstream, and our ability to have meaningful face-to-face interactions began to wane. Today, whenever there's a lull in conversation or a moment of solitude, people whip out their phones to check their emails, texts, Snapchat messages, and Facebook feeds. 9 out of 10 cell phone users admit to having used their phones during the last social gathering they attended. Under our phone's distracting influence, our attention is often divided and colored by impatience. Deep one-on-one conversation is increasingly rare, and so is true solitude. Smartphones, we're discovering, are not accessories, but psychologically potent devices that change not just what we do, but who we are. It's deja vu all over again, said Claude Fisher in the Boston Review. 50 years ago, Turkle might well have heard similar grousing about people eating together silently, or burying their noses in the newspaper, or, heaven knows, turning away to watch the always-on TV set. Despite her use of scary anecdotes and alarmist generalizations, there's no systematic, reliable evidence to prove that technology is changing people in some fundamental negative way. As for lovely, meaningful interaction, said Tracy Moore in Jezebel.com, I'll tell you how most of us spent the 90s, the era when our lives were smartphone-free. We got high, watched bad TV, went to shows, drank a lot of beer. We humans have always been prone to shallowness and self-absorption, with or without a smartphone in our pockets. But you have to be blind not to see that smartphones really are changing how people behave, said Simon Cooper in FT.com. For many young people, life now happens on phones, with everything else, study, school, face-to-face interaction, serving as a mere backdrop. Psychologists have found a 40% decline in empathy among college students, with most of the decline taking place after 2000. Studies have shown the mere presence of a phone makes face-to-face conversations between people more superficial, since an interruption can happen at any second. Binging on connectivity, like binging on food, is bad for you, and we need to establish a new social norm that will shame people who check their phones during mealtimes, meetings, or personal conversations. Collectively, we went too far, and now we need new collective rules to restore sanity. Fantasy sports, a sucker's game? Turn on your TV right now and you'll probably see a fantasy sports commercial before you can count to 10, said Norman Chad in the Washington Post. The airwaves are being flooded with get-rich-quick messages from FanDuel and DraftKings, the two leading firms that have turned fantasy leagues into sports betting on steroids. In traditional fantasy leagues, friends assemble hypothetical teams and see whose players have the best cumulative statistics on the field over a whole season. But FanDuel and DraftKings organize daily and weekly fantasy games for football, baseball, and other sports. To lure the gullible, entry fees are as little as 25 cents. Prizes run into the seven figures. Pick your players, pick up your cash, DraftKings proclaims in its ads, as if there were no chance of losing. Fantasy sports were excluded from a law banning online gaming because they're considered games of skill, said the New York Times in an editorial. But encouraging fans to bet will inevitably threaten the integrity of sports and create more gambling addicts. The moral panic over fantasy sports betting is misguided, said Seth Stevenson in Slate.com. Are DraftKings and FanDuel any worse than government lotteries or online trading? More than 41 million Americans and Canadians played fantasy sports last year, and one study found that 80% of players lose less than $10 a month. Most consider that a fair price for the entertainment of playing and the burst of adrenaline it produces. But fantasy sports leagues make suckers of casual fans, said Neil Irwin in the New York Times. The top 1.3% of players rake in 77% of the winnings because they spend hours each day feeding data about players into customized predictive algorithms and submit hundreds of different team entries. How do you compete with that? That reality won't stop the explosive growth of fantasy sports, said Michael Rand in the Minneapolis Star Tribune, because getting rich quick is the new American dream. Americans used to believe that if they worked hard enough, they could climb the economic ladder and eventually become rich. But as the gap between the rich and the poor has widened, belief in that ideal has faded. Instead, people now pin their hopes on all-or-nothing fantasies. The wild popularity of DraftKings and FanDuel is a reflection, for better or worse, of America. Speaking of football, for the first time since 2009, the NFL in September went an entire calendar month without any of its players being arrested. The most recent arrest came on August 26th. Over the past couple of months, the most asked question about 2016 presidential candidates on Google were from people who wanted to know Hillary Clinton's age, Jeb Bush's height, and Donald Trump's net worth. The number of children ages 6 to 17 playing team sports is down 4% from 2009, with more parents encouraging their kids to specialize in one sport in hopes of getting a college scholarship. In that high-pressure atmosphere, 70% of kids now quit organized sports by age 13. And we'll finish up today with a quote, this one from Henry Kissinger, quoted in the, in the New York Times. Mr. Kissinger says, "Nobody will ever win the battle of the sexes. There's just too much fraternizing with the enemy." We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.